Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Bottled. The 21st episode today is with my friend, the incredible Jenna Ong. Jenna is passionate about effective altruism, and she's an advocate for the need and the importance of effective altruism in the world today. Now, what is effective altruism? Well, it's something we'll find out in the podcast today. But in a nutshell, it's about doing good things for the world in the most useful and the most effective way possible. To dive more into that, we have Jenna Ong today, part one of episode number 21. Please enjoy.
Get speakers in and that sort of thing, and it's a really good group that meets, and we have chats into the night.
Before we move forward to that, Jenna, welcome to Bottled.
Oh, thank you.
But I'm very excited for this episode, and it's primarily because of what we're going to talk about today, which is effective altruism, primarily, possibly branching into other topics as well, depending on how we go. But you were talking about this event that goes on at ANU on a weekly basis.
Yes.
Could you run through that again?
Sure. I do want to say it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for here.
Thank you.
And I'm excited about this chat too. I hope I can do the topic justice. I'm no expert in effective altruism, but over the last few months I have gotten quite interested in it. It's probably been a year now. And I still feel like there's a lot of learning to do, a lot of exploring. It's a really fascinating thing.
No, I can vouch for that, because ever since we decided on doing this episode, I've been sort of looking into it as well.
Yeah, nice.
And it's for me at least, it's a very new concept to grasp. And that's why there's a lot of challenges for me to understand what it really is. And that's why I'm really looking forward to this discussion, because, you know, listening to someone who's been in that field for however long you've been, and it's not just the time, but the effort you put in as well.
Yeah.
Things I've heard from other people and your diary and stuff. And it's I'm really looking forward to understanding about this.
Yeah, cheers. I'm looking forward to hearing your perspectives based on your reading so far.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting, because it's a very interesting topic. Primarily because, firstly, it's new, and it sounds like something you know, but you don't. And you know you have to, but you aren't. For me at least. So let's start off with this event that you were talking about.
Weekly at So every week the club gets together. It's a uni club here in Canberra. Mm-hmm. So at the ANU, Australian National University, there's a student club, and although I'm not a student currently, I was a student a little while ago, but I have found myself in this club. Thanks to a friend of mine, Nick, asking if I wanted to help out after meeting him at a party, and I was really interested in what they did. And it's the only club in Canberra that represents effective altruism, sort of talks about effective altruism as far as we know. So I think they've tried to set up the Canberra club, but didn't really gain traction. They'll probably try again, because I don't know how hard they tried last time, but for now, I think there's just the one club in Canberra, and heaps of clubs elsewhere. Yeah. I'm going on massive tangents.
No,
asked about the events.
No, that's okay. That's exactly what Bottled is about. It just goes everywhere.
And
it's just,
good.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of it, I think.
Maybe it would be good if I try and define it first.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah. It's both a philosophy and a movement, a kind of community of people. So I guess it's a few things from that angle, but essentially at the core, I would define it as a philosophy and a movement that's interested in the question of how do we do the most good with our limited time and resources. There's a lot of interventions out there, like charities, movements, campaigns, initiatives that aim to do good. I'm sure they're really trying to do good, and a lot of them probably do, but a lot of them also don't. And it's been found, like the effect of altruists kind of discovered quite early on that, well, before that time, like, no one really tried to look at, like, logical sort of evidence-based ways to do things. I just think it's such a kind of 101 question as to, like, how can we do... how can we show that we're, like, doing the most good? Because a lot of charities don't, like...
Yeah.
I hate to single charities out, but, like, World Vision, for example, which I have, I sponsored a child for a short while, and I think they do good work, and they probably do, but they don't really prove it, you know? They don't really have evidence to show... So you're just kind of throwing money there and hoping that it will do good. Mm. And, like, a lot of people are doing things with the hope that they do good, but it turns out there's a whole community of people who also find evidence for doing good, for, like, you know, the interventions that do the most good.
Yeah.
So given that there's a way we can kind of prove which charities are, like, doing better or worse, or which it's not necessarily charities, it could be just, like, research or... policy changes. Like, if we could prove that some do a lot more good than others, why wouldn't we divert our time and our money there?
And
they found that, like, the best charities are hundreds of times better than the worst charities.
And the reason why it's also called a community or a movement or people is because you, the people, as a part of the effective altruism movement, you gather evidence and check which donation has the most impact, or what's the best way of doing things in terms of, let's say, for example, eliminating poverty or just bringing a child food.
So, like, there's a range of people within the community, and there's definitely some who focus on global health and poverty concerns, like current concerns, like the charity GiveWell. Sorry, not charity. They're like a charity evaluator. And, like, that's their focus. There's also other people in the EA community who do who focus more on long-term risks, like existential humanity kind of risks. There's a lot to say about that topic. Yeah, like, the basic concept there is just because someone is living in the future, like, just because someone hasn't been born yet doesn't mean their welfare is any less important than the people living now. And when you think about how many more people are going to live in future compared to the present and the past, it's like, I can't remember the, like, exact order of magnitude, but it's like heaps and heaps more people is estimated, you know, before
the projections, like, billions of people in the next, like, 10 years.
Right.
Yeah, almost a billion. Sorry, I apologize. Not billions, but I think...
And then, like, thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of years into the future, if we don't kill ourselves before then, like, there would be even more people to think about. So there's, like, a whole sort of sub-movement of people within EA who are looking at mitigating risks for those people, because there are, like, massive existential potential nuclear disasters or... AI, artificial intelligence risks are, like, quite a hot topic because of some great minds basically, you know, calling that out as a really major issue. There's climate change, there's global pandemics, as we know, like, that could wipe out future humans. So that's a pretty important area. Although
and things are very evident right now in terms of, like, global change or, sorry, climate change, and especially the deforestation problems as well that we discussed in the past. But I wanted to sort of dive into that, what you mentioned about gathering evidence. What's the process of how do you, so even the GiveWell Foundation, which apparently is very popular with effective altruism, how do you gather evidence? What's the process there?
Well,
where do you go first?
I wish I could say for sure, because, I mean, GiveWell is an awesome organization and it would be, like, amazing to work there, but I do not. And I don't know exactly how they do it, but I have a sense of it from looking at some of their spreadsheets. So they're really open about how they estimate cost effectiveness, and how they identify the top charities to donate to. Basically, GiveWell is a organization and a website that lists out, like, the top charities that sort of pass their benchmark. For they they've found that there's like really good evidence for those charities doing good, and like they base it on so they don't necessarily do the studies, but the organizations will have done like randomized control trials and other things to measure the effectiveness of what they're doing. So for example, one of the charities that GiveWell recommends is called what's not really charity, I don't really know the terminology to use, but
for GiveWell,
like for this one initiative, it's called the Deworm the World initiative.
I haven't heard of that yet.
Okay. It's an interesting one, and yeah, a lot of people haven't heard about it. That's partly because I guess worms aren't really a sexy topic. Like, who wants to talk about worms? But also probably just because that particular initiative like doesn't do nearly as much advertising as, say, World Vision or UNICEF or
Kids with Cancer.
Yeah. And like, maybe it's because they're diverting their money to more like effective things. But basically, with the Deworm the World initiative, which I think is part of like the organization Evidence Action, they have like super cost-effective ways to like remove parasitic worms from kids. I think it's primarily kids in that, for that org, who suffer from parasitic worms. And it's like a really interesting origin kind of story for this organization. I mentioned earlier like that something happened in 1993, which was a bit pivotal to the movement, right? And that thing
just
was...
Before you proceed, is that a part of the Effective Altruism Program or movement as well, the organization?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Got it. Yeah, continue, please. Yeah.
Yeah. Just on that note, briefly, like, I would say, you know, it's not like a rigidly defined thing. I feel like anyone who's thinking about how to do the most good with their limited time and resources is probably thinking in an effectively altruistic way, you know. It's not like there's some stamp of approval that you get from, you know, being a certain, being considered EA or not, like, I kind of think.
It's not a union kind of thing. Like, it's, it's like a philosophy that you adapt. Yeah,
exactly. So, in 1993... if I've got my dates right, there was a guy called like Michael Kramer. To be honest, I do not know how to pronounce his last name because I've only read this.
Lee Kramer from Seinfeld?
Could be. I read about this in the book, in a book by Will McCaskill, who's like one of the founding fathers of EA. And so this guy, Michael, I'll just call him Michael.
That's okay.
He was like on a vacation or something in Kenya, back around 1993, and he had a friend there. I think it was Paul L. I can't remember his name. Anyway, his friend had a charity there, and the charity was, I think, a Christian charity, which was trying to improve education rates, like rates of attendance, especially. In schools in Kenya, because there's a big issue with like kids not getting not going through school entirely in Kenya, and then like as a result the economy is like not as strong, and there's just a lot of education related issues in Kenya. And so this friend of Michael's was Michael was trying to set up this charity. I think he already had a charity, and he was gonna provide schools with like more resources, like flip charts and books and stationery and teachers, and maybe some other things to like try and improve attendance. Like, they thought that it would help, you know. And so he was about to like start dispensing these things when Michael urged his friend to try and maybe do a randomized control trial to make sure that his intervention was working.
Yeah.
So his friend agreed, and like for 7 schools he gave them like stationery, and they tested each one by one, like stationery, more books, and more teachers. And then for the other seven schools, they didn't do anything. It was a control group. And they discovered that none of those things made a difference to attendance rates.
As in providing stationery or...
Or books. Or extra teachers. The books one, partly because the books were in English, and these Kenyans at school did not speak English yet, or not much. You know, these kids are still learning. And so the books were really quite lost in them. So that was a classic example of, like, money spent with no impact. And they kept trying things. You know, they weren't disheartened. They were like, well, maybe something else will work. You know, maybe, I don't know, we'll... I don't know what else they tried, but they kept trying different things. And finally, someone, I think a friend of theirs from the World Health Organization, like, suggested, why don't you try deworming pills? Like, why don't you kind of help treat these kids of the parasitic worms that were quite prevalent in that area? And they were surprised to find that not only did this intervention help, but it was, like, hugely impactful. So much so that they did, like, a follow-up study, like, 10 years later or something, where they tracked those kids, like, and they saw what incomes they had as a result of, like, you know, the kids who had been dewormed when they were in school were compared with, like, the kids who hadn't been dewormed. And they were earning, like, a substantial amount more in income.
Because their cognitive powers increased as well.
Because they, yeah, they were able to go through with their education.
That's crazy.
And it was so successful that the program was shown to have, like, paid for itself. Because the government would be spending, like, very little money. It costs less than a dollar, Aussie dollars, less than 50 cents US and less than a dollar Aussie to deworm, like, to treat a child of parasitic worms. I think you have to do it, like, twice a year, sometimes once a year, maybe sometimes once in 3 months, like, depending on the area and how bad it is. But it's just, like, a few times a year, and it costs, like, less than a dollar per child, and it substantially improves their quality of life. So it doesn't really save their life. Like, worms don't kill a child. They just, like, drastically kind of affect their health so much. That's a large reason why they weren't going to school, because they were just too sick. And you can see there how, like, this deworming pill was, like, super cost effective. Whereas, like, extra books had, like, zero
infrastructure that doesn't make sense to the kids. Because they're not feeling well. They don't want to go to school.
Exactly.
Because of worms or a headache. Caused by the worms.
So amazing, like, discovery, and the first time that the scientific method had been applied to, like, the developing, you know, what do you call it? The, like, development space, like, global health and poverty kind of concerns. And that's, like, I feel like that was probably, like, a major kickstarter for, like, the whole movement. I mean, I think there were other things going on at the time, but, like, just the idea of, like, applying those scientific methods to the development world is just feels like it should have been done sooner to me, you know, sooner, earlier than 1993. But, yeah, I guess it's a relatively new movement. And, yeah, for that reason, kind of important.
You can vouch for this, but I think the problem is... so I was doing this a bit of research on effective altruism as well, and... one example in particular, because it was so simple and it related to me more because I'm not as invested in this as you are, is that when you want to buy a laptop or when you want to purchase something from the market, you do so much research about it. You review it. You see what the specs are. If I'm buying a computer, if I want to invest $900 on it, I see what the graphics cards are. I see what the fan does, what company the
fan
is. But we're not doing the same when you want to donate to a certain organization. And I was checking what the psychology behind this is. And as I read somewhere that it's that, you know, as human beings, we find it hard to empathize with others. And I think the reason why effective altruism can work is because you're really empathizing with the other person, seeing where exactly the core issue is. what really is happening, rather than trusting an organization that has a beautifully built website and not a very transparent way of showing where your funds are, but rather being empathetic and looking to see, like, just, you know, putting it under a microscope and checking what the issue is. And I think, and just to answer my own question from earlier, I don't think you need a process for effective altruism. I think it's just observe, check what the issue is. Would that be correct as well? Like, just checking what the issues are?
Yeah, I think it definitely has to start with a hell of a lot of observation to figure out, like, what's going on in the community that you might be trying to help. Because sometimes we're wrong. Like, there's that great, have you heard of the Play Pumps?
What was that again?
Play Pumps?
No, what's that?
It's a bit of a classic failure story that I actually came across way back, like, outside of EA, but it's definitely been discussed in EA as well. It's basically this this new product that was created with the best of intentions. It was a water pump for a village. And, like, the intention was for kids to play on it. You know, in a playground, there's, like, a spinning... For some playgrounds, there are, like, there's, like, a spinning platform, and you jump on it, like, you run alongside it for a while, you jump on, it's like, whee! So it's meant to be fun. And, like, the premise was that these kids in the village would play on the pump, and, like, at the same time, it would pump water for the village, and this would eliminate the need for women and children to walk, like, many miles to access water, and so... You know, someone from the first world thought this was a great intervention, like, let's do this, but they didn't consult the community, and they didn't really try it out properly. Like, I think they didn't really test it out. They just assumed it would work. It was a great concept, and it got, like, rave reviews when it first started up. Everyone was like, this is a fantastic idea, play pumps, what could be better? But when the community actually used it, they found it wasn't fun. So the kids didn't play on it. Reason it's not fun is because the, like, that playground equipment is fun due to momentum. Like, you're running along for a while, and then when you jump on, there's momentum in a normal playground spinny thing, whatever it's called. And so you keep spinning and you go, whee! But with the play pump, you had to keep on spinning it for it to work. So these kids would, like, spin and spin all day, but never really get the wee.
Yeah, they were more fatigued or tired.
Yeah.
Because I think with the other one, there's a bearing in there, so it sort of makes it easier to... So it just spins.
Exactly.
With minimum effort.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, got it, yeah.
And that's what's fun about it.
Yeah.
But because it wasn't fun, the villagers were like, well, we actually prefer the hand pump. Mm-hmm. They're, like, old. They're old technology, just a manual thing. And so that was, like, a big waste of money. Through not observing enough in the community.
And not asking the right questions or looking at the right place.
Yeah, that's it.
Because there's a massive gap, like you said earlier, between the poorer countries or the third world, as they tag it, and the first world. Because we're living in extreme wealth, honestly. If you're at least working a 9-to-5 job or whatever job, even a retail job, you can at least live a very comfortable life in a country like Australia, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But it's not the same overseas.
It really isn't. And like, everywhere else, almost, we're in, like, the top 1% of richest people in the world if we earn over $70,000 Aussie a year. And if you earn over $40,000, you're still in the top 5% richest.
Yeah.
So I think, like, when we spend our money here, like, maybe, you know, things cost a bit more here. So there's this idea in EA that, like, which is true, just the fact that your money does go further overseas. Like, you could do a lot more for people overseas with, like, the same amount of money. I think it's been shown that happiness, if you can measure it, like, increases by the same amount with every doubling of income. So, like, if someone's earning, like, to take an extreme, like, maybe $500 a year overseas, and you double their income, by giving them $500 in that year.
Yeah.
It's like hardly anything off you, but you're doubling their income. So you're increasing their happiness by the same amount that you would increase your happiness if you doubled your, I don't know, $80,000 income. Yeah. Like, imagine getting like $160,000 a year instead of $80,000. It's like, whoo, I would be happy.
Exactly.
And so you could do the same for someone else. Having said all this, like, I don't advocate like sending all your money overseas and just like not spending on yourself, because I think there's a real danger in not like taking care of yourself enough.
Not treating yourself.
Yeah. And I think even in the EA community, which is a bit obsessed with like trying to do the most good, they like very much, there's a very popular, you know, sentiment there that you have to look after yourself first. Like, you have to take care of your own like health and well-being, because we can't really help other people long term if we are, you know, like giving all our money away. And
No, absolutely. But what you said about your money overseas goes a long way, it's still true because of the conversion rates as well, and the cost of living is so cheaper there. And there's a lot of organizations sending money overseas as well, like donating money overseas. But what I have noticed is, so I'm from Nepal, which has been through so much in the past 20 years in terms of earthquake, royal massacre, political instability. And I've noticed that when you donate through these websites or organizations, I can't think of any at this point in time, but when you do donate, I don't know what happens, but I can't see, I just can't see the money going to the right hands.
Just disappears into the other.
Yeah. But my friends back in Nepal, God bless them, because they are activists. Like, they're always running around, going to villages, even during the earthquake when I was there. We went to villages, we helped the community out, and we preferred to do it by ourselves, not through organizations.
Right.
And what you said, I think, is especially true in poorer countries. The fact that people there are more effective in terms of charity and donation and activism than big organizations are.
Oh, I think that direct impact is like really valuable and amazing that like you helped out with that, and you know, you and your friends would like, you could see the problems firsthand and you could do something about it rather than us being quite removed in Australia. And like, often it is the community themselves who knows what's best for them, like not us in some far removed land, which is why this one charity works really well. It's called Give Directly, and they are one of GiveWell's like top as well. And they, like, they give direct transfers, like you can send money directly to people who are in extreme poverty, and they are empowered to do what they need with it. And like, some people have argued that, oh, you know, if you just give money to poor people, they'll spend it on booze and like drugs and that sort of thing. Absolutely not. At least with this organization, I don't know how they manage it, but I think it's true to say that like, people who really are in extreme poverty are like, they know what's, they know what they need. Give Directly found that people were using it to build houses for themselves, or, you know, to start businesses that so that they could earn their own money. And that's really effective. Like, they are just humans like us. Like, there would be some of them probably who might prefer alcohol, but like, the vast majority would probably not. They'd probably, you know.
Absolutely. You know, in places where there is poverty, obviously there are problems like crime and alcohol problems. There's a lot of that. I've seen that firsthand as well. But like you said as well, not entirely. There's a lot of good people out there who want to do good for themselves. And you're in that position not because of, not necessarily because of the decisions that you've taken, but because of where you are, what your surrounding is, what your commitments were growing up, and all of these things as well.
Yeah, so as
a part of effective altruism,
do
you or people who are activists globally, is there a lot of traveling involved as well to meet people from these communities?
That's an interesting question. I think there would be like differing opinions in the community as to whether that's a good spend of money, like whether that's an effective spend of money. I know that, like, listening to some podcasts,
yeah,
by 80,000 Hours, which is awesome organization.
Yeah, I was listening to it the other day.
Yeah, nice.
It's amazing. Yeah.
It is. We should talk more about that in a sec. I just recently heard some podcasts where the guy was talking about how he travels quite a bit to, like, meet with organizations who could provide grants. So I guess that's not so much like traveling directly to the communities that are in need. I don't think EAs, like effective altruists, do that very much because it costs quite a lot to travel, and there's a sentiment that volunteering is not the most effective way because, like, you're spending a lot of time, and we're all sort of limited human beings in terms of space and our actions. Like, we can only help so many people with our actions.
Yeah.
But if we send $100 to the deworming initiative, we could, like, treat 100 kids from worms. And we can't do that ourselves with, like, you know, in 2 minutes, like we can by doing it. So I think there's, like, not very much of that, but there's a lot of networking with other effective altruists because it is quite a globally spread movement and community.
Yeah.
So I think it started in Oxford, UK,
among,
like, philosophers and mathematicians and economists who were, like, quite nerdy.
Yeah,
yeah, he's definitely one of them. And I think GiveWell is in California, and there's quite a few in Australia.
ANU.
Probably not. Yeah, ANU's.
Which I know is a part of.
I mean, we're a bit smaller in Australia, I guess, just due to a smaller population.
Starts.
But, like, there's definitely a few people quite involved in all that, you know.
Yeah, no, good to know, because a conventional way of really understanding the world or helping others out is to travel to places.
Yeah.
No, it's good to know that that's not really a priority, because I'm still trying to understand how effective altruism is different to, or the process in particular is different to other donations or charities. And that seems like it's one of the pillars of that. Like, forget about the conventional way of helping the world. Just look at the figures and the facts.
Yeah. I mean, in the, like, global health and poverty space, there's a real focus, I would say, on cost effectiveness, because there's a lot of things like health interventions that are already happening that you can measure. But in other areas, like, animal welfare is a bit harder to measure, and it's, like, one of the key cause areas, like, something that's talked a lot in the EA community is, like, how to make sure animals are not suffering as much as they currently do, both in captivity, like, you know, on farms, and also potentially in the wild. Like, that's a whole other kind of fringe topic, I guess. The wild animal suffering is a big question. But, like, that's one where I would say it's not necessarily about, like, finding evidence. Similarly with long-termism, future stuff, like, we don't have evidence for the long-term future. You know, we'll probably be gone by the time we know whether the interventions we're doing now have worked. So one other key, like, principle, I guess, besides cost effectiveness, is just, like, careful reasoning. Like I mentioned, there's a few philosophers, this was sort of started by philosophers, and they spend a lot of time thinking carefully in a really, like, considered manner about morality and, you know, like, why animals might be as important as humans. It's a great Peter Singer excerpt, although he's a controversial figure, but I do really agree with what he says about how with animals, in terms of, like, our treatment of them, it's not about whether they are sentient, it's not about whether they can think or whether they can experience joy, it's about whether they can suffer. You know, that's the key question, like, can they suffer? And I guess maybe can they suffer as much as us? And if they can, then what we are doing to them is like as bad as kind of what we're doing, you know, as bad as doing it to humans. I'm no expert in, like, animal welfare stuff, but I just think that's a really interesting concept and just kind of shows how, like,
so Peter Singer advocates for the fact that if animals can suffer as much as we can, or suffer to a certain extent that we treat them, then that's their place. Is that what he's advocating? Or
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
Oh, that's okay. So, if animals can suffer to a certain extent,
yeah.
Sorry, I missed the whole point of what Singer was trying to say about.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, I probably didn't describe it well.
No, that's okay.
So, I guess there's a lot of philosophical debates about whether we should care about animal welfare.
Yeah.
Like, should we kill chickens and kill cows like for beef and and some philosophers would say no, because they're not as cognitively advanced as humans, so their welfare maybe doesn't matter as much because they can't think like us, they can't reason, they also maybe can't think about the future as clearly, so they can't preempt, they have less worry time if they're going into a slaughterhouse, they won't know it, so their suffering is maybe less. I think there's some value to that argument, maybe they don't quite know what's happening, so it's not as worrying as if a human was being brought into a slaughterhouse, but at the end of the day, if they're being killed, Peter Singer's argument is, what's important, the question we have to ask is can they suffer? Because I guess that's the reason why we wouldn't kill a being. Understood. Because they might suffer. And it's just one philosophical standpoint, but it's one that I happen to agree with.
No, absolutely.
That's the important kind
that's
of question.
Interesting, because, and like you said, he's a very controversial figure as well, because I read an article on ABC about a book by Peter Singer, and the topic of the article was why effective altruism is not effective. And I was sort of skimming through it, and I'll be happy to go through a line as well that I found very interesting, so we can dive more into that as well.
Sure.
I didn't entirely agree with the article, but I'll try and locate that line.
Yeah, sure. I wanted to go back as well to something you were talking about earlier, to do with, you were talking about how when we buy things for ourselves, we do a lot of research. Yep. I mean, maybe not everyone does, but I can certainly see that you do. And, you look at the specs of a computer and get really comprehensive about it. I think that's a really good point, that it's interesting that we do that for ourselves and in a lot of areas of our lives. We do a lot of research, but when it comes to donating or doing, other good, probably especially donations, we don't do that much research. And I'm curious, curious to explore why. I guess one thing is there's not a lot of widely publicized research, so we just kind of assume it's not there. I know before I found EA, I kind of just went off what percentage of the money went to a certain intervention. So, I think, World Vision is 80%. So 80% of their funds. I saw two different numbers on two different sources, but anyway, say a charity donates 80% of its of what we give to the actual people in need, and the 20% is overheads, admin, and that sort of thing. It's that's a really common metric to go by, I feel, when people are doing research on charities, if they do any. It's I guess this one gives more money to the people in need.
Let's go for that. Yeah,
but I don't know why I never considered how flawed that was when I was a kid, thinking, just because more money goes towards people in need, I think I just assumed it would be effective, it would make a difference. But what if that charity was the charity who was giving school books to children in Kenya who didn't need extra school books? It's not necessarily effective, even if we're giving a large portion of that money away.
Yeah.
And I guess another reason is, often when if we're donating, well, sometimes at least, we might be kind of regaled by someone in the middle of a shopping center who's please sponsor a child, and it's a bit of obligation, and they tell us some key facts that kind of sound really And they might well work. I'm not doubting that they work, you know. It's just that there's no evidence for it.
Yeah.
And so wouldn't you rather kind of support a charity where there is evidence and you can be sure?
Mm.
Like today, I got an email in the morning, finally, from GiveWell. I've been waiting for a little while, but they do it quarterly, telling me like how much a certain donation helped. It was like, oh, they just wrote to me saying like, hey, Jenna, like, thanks for the donation. This amount, like, provided like 892 treatments to people with vitamin A deficiency and like 10 malaria bed nets, like malaria preventing bed nets. And like, it was really cool having those kind of concrete, you know, like, I guess real altruism is like when you do something for someone else without any feelings for yourself. But I feel like that's not realistic. Like, as humans, we like that little satisfaction. Like, part of the reason I donate is to feel kind of good. Yes. Like,
some people do it for karma. Like, good
karma.
And I do it to feel good for myself as well.
Awesome.
You're right.
And I really don't think that's wrong. Like, if you feel good at the same time, it's a win-win situation, you know?
Yeah.
And I also kind of think, like, at the end of my life, if I haven't done anything else, you know, if I just end up living a boring life, at least I will be able to say to myself on my deathbed, you know, I helped these kids,
exactly,
saved a life or two.